Yes, I still have mine's macrame.
Today is Monday, February 16th, 2015. I call to order the House Committee on Human Services and Housing. Before we start, I would like to inform everyone that while we will hold work sessions today on House Bill 2091, 2113 and 2115, I don't expect to move these bills today, but rather gather more information in preparation for future action. The part of the reason that we're not moving ahead on some of these child care tax credits is because we are still waiting for House Bill 2116, which is the dependent care tax credit that we've been comparing the working family tax credit to, and we don't want to take any action until we actually have the bills that we're going to be considering so we can consider them together. And also next Friday, we're going to be looking at some of the tax credits on health, elderly, and disabilities, and because dependent care also deals with a little bit of that population, I think it's important that we view all of these before we actually take any action. We are going to be taking action on 2114, so I'm going to open a work session on that one. I'm just going to open a work session on House Bill 2114 for the purpose of re-referring it. Representative Stark.
Chair Kingeyer, I move that House Bill 2114, without recommendation for passage, be referred to the Speaker's desk to be referred to the Committee on Business and Labor and to the Joint Committee on Tax Credits by prior reference.
Representative Stark moves House Bill 2114 without recommendation to the Speaker's desk to be referred to the Committee on Business and Labor and to the Joint Committee on Tax Credits by prior reference. For clarification, that is the one that has to do with the employers getting a tax credit for offering child care, and that is really more appropriately held by the Business and Labor. So is there any discussion on that? Okay, seeing none, the clerk will call the roll.
Rep. Mueller?
Yes.
Rep. Evans?
Yes.
Rep. Gallegos?
Yes.
Rep. Hayden?
Yes.
Rep. Parrott?
Yes.
Rep. Taylor?
Excused.
Vice Chair Stark?
Yes.
Vice Chair Calusa?
Yes.
Chair Kingeyer?
Yes. The motion passes. The measure is sent to the Speaker's desk for re-referral. Close the work session on 2114, and I will open the work session to introduce the committee concepts. 2091.
Oh, 20, is that right?
Where are we here? Okay, I'm going to open the work session on House Bill 2091, 2113, and 2115. And I call on Chris Olenek to the witness desk to share further information on these bills, and also because we will be getting 2116, the Child and Dependent Care Credit, that was just referred to our committee and will show up here soon.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee.
I also want to point out that staff copied a few pages of this to make sure that you had some of the relevant pages that were on OLIS the first time these were introduced, but we thought we'd make it easy and put it right in front of you.
Thank you.
So, Madam Chair, members of the committee, so I put together some information. This whole review process is still a little bit new, and we're finding our legs on it. And so I put together a PowerPoint to try and walk through, touching on the process a little bit, as well as providing a little bit more information, and then wrapping up with some kind of policy options to just kind of keep the conversation going. This is still a work in progress, but that's generally what this is. So again, just to start for context and framework, the policy questions, these were, I believe, handed out, distributed to the committee from either the revenue chairs or leadership, and they were also in Appendix D of the tax credit report. And at a high level, these were some of the things that our understanding is leadership would like from the policy committees. a statement of the public policy purpose, some description of who the beneficiaries are, discussions of ramifications of a complete sunset, that's kind of a policy option, review of administrative and compliance costs, perhaps, if appropriate, a comparison to direct appropriation. So in this case, that might be the ERDC program along with the tax credits. And then any potential structural changes. So that's really the backdrop for the discussion. And I'm going to touch on a few of these with the information in this PowerPoint. If you have any questions, feel free to interrupt.
Just members of the committee, the list of questions are the last page in your packet if you haven't located them yet. So you do actually have a paper behind your agenda on the on the last page. It will be appendix. Thank you, Madam Chair. My apologies.
I guess I would add the questions. I've fielded some questions about the questions, and it's not necessarily a list, a to-do list of things to answer or get definitive answers. Some of the questions are difficult to answer. They're really meant to prompt a discussion as the chair and the committee sees fit on whichever tax credits. So the two that I'm going to focus on here today are the consumer child care tax credits, the child independent care tax credit, which is on its way to the committee, and the working family child care tax credit. So getting at a policy purpose from the information that I've heard from some people, from witnesses who have testified and from within the committee, there seem to be at least two overarching policy purposes for these tax credits. One would be to offset child care costs, and a second is to provide some financial assistance for working parents. And thinking about those policy purposes, they don't have to be mutually exclusive. The financial assistance for working parents can be measured by the child care costs. There is the notion of taxpayers are conceptually getting this once a year. On April 15th, they file their tax return, and then they get the check once a year, as opposed to modifying the policy somehow so that there is less withholding in a taxpayer's paycheck, so they're kind of getting the credit throughout the year. And that had been discussed at the federal level. That had been done with the EIC, the Earned Income Tax Credit. The feds no longer do that for a variety of reasons, but those are just some of the things that I've heard in what I've listened to in the committee so far. One of the questions that comes up, and in looking at some of the tables, there's a lot of tax terminology that I'm not sure that everybody's familiar with. So I'm going to go through at a very high level kind of a flow chart of the tax calculation. So if there are any tax purists listening to this, hopefully they won't be too offended by how I've glossed over a lot of pieces of it, but it's really just conceptual and trying to get at some key terms. So the federal tax calculation, and we are tied to federal law, so we start off with the federal definitions of income. You have wages, business income, and interest income. These will be, I think everybody understands wages. Business income, this will be from generally small businesses. They will be your sole proprietors. They can be S-Corps. They can be partnerships. They can be LLCs, kind of the flow-through entities. Interest there, oftentimes it gets referred to unearned income, and that would include interest and dividends and capital gains. And there's another category. There are a lot of other miscellaneous pieces of income, but these three account for about 85% of all income. So these are the major pieces, with wages by far being the largest category on the whole. So from that income, certain adjustments are made, certain deductions. These are, or at least they used to be referred to as above-the-line deductions, and these are deductions that everybody can take, and they are referred to as adjustments. Contributions to standard IRA accounts, and there's a deduction for student loan interest. And there are probably 10 or 12 of these that everybody is allowed to take. And so that results in adjusted gross income. So that second quarter, that's where the adjusted in the adjusted gross income. So that top category is really gross income minus adjustments leads to adjusted gross income. And this is usually the metric used for a lot of tax statistics and thinking about the income tax. It's what most people think of. If you stop people on the street, you know, and ask them what their income is, this will be most similar to what the number that they would give you. And that's where the AGI is important, because some of the phase outs of tax credits are measured on AGI. So from AGI, we have, at the federal level, personal exemptions and deductions. At the federal level, there's a personal exemption for each member of the household. I believe it's in the neighborhood of $4,000 now. In comparison, Oregon has a personal exemption tax credit. So at the federal level, there's just a certain amount of income that is not subject to tax. It walks and talks, so to speak, like a deduction. It's basically a reduction in income that would be taxed. And deductions here, it is either the standard deduction or itemized deductions, the Schedule A deductions. So from AGI, minus those two, results in federal taxable income. And this is the amount of income to which the federal tax rates are applied. And there is the one tax credit, the Oregon Child Independent Care Credit, which phases out on federal taxable income. And I'll get to some of the differences between the two. Generally speaking, federal taxable income as a percentage of AGI can be anywhere from 5% to 85%. It's a lower amount. And I have an example.
Can I stop you there? Do I remember correctly that the federal tax credit for child and dependent care is actually pegged to the AGI, whereas the state version is actually pegged to the federal taxable income? It's one of the differences between ours and the federal that we may want to bring in alignment.
That's correct, Madam Chair. Okay. And later on, I have...
You have a chart that shows that.
Yeah, I walk through an example, and roughly speaking, on average, AGI of about $85,000 tends to be about the same as federal taxable income of about $45,000. So if you want to... And these are all averages, and a lot of stuff gets lumped together here. So federal taxable income, if you're talking about a taxpayer with federal taxable income of $45,000, on average, their AGI is going to be about $85,000.
So one implication of that, our state one, doing it on the federal taxable income, means that we are actually allowing people with higher incomes to claim the state credit, whereas the feds limit it to, they cut it off at a, oh no, except for they never mind. We'll get to that on the chart.
Yeah, the feds have a phase down.
Yes.
Okay, so that's the federal law. The Oregon calculation, we start with AGI. And this flow chart is, I don't have it on there, I guess, it's for full year filers. So for the Oregon tax calculation, we start with with adjusted gross income. And then from that, we have some things that we add to that, and then we have other things that we subtract. So we have puts and takes. So one of the additions is bond interest. Bond interest for state and local bonds not outside of Oregon. That's not taxed at the federal level, but we tax other states' bond interest, or the interest from other states' bonds. And then we have some subtractions, which again, this is another, it's kind of a code word within the tax system. It's a kind of deduction. And there are several subtractions. One of the most prominent ones is Social Security income. According to the Oregon Constitution, the state cannot tax Social Security income, but the feds do tax a portion of Social Security income. So the amount, one of the income components over here is Social Security income. And so that shows up, and that's part of federal AGI. So we subtract it out here. As per the Oregon Constitution, we're not allowed to tax Social Security income. And so there are a handful of subtractions. And then we take away deductions. We have the standard deduction, and then we also tie to Schedule A deductions. We just take the same ones as the feds. And then that equals Oregon taxable income. So the key phrases here with some of the credits, we have adjusted gross income, which will be the same number for Oregon and for the federal. And then you have federal taxable income and Oregon taxable income. And these will be different amounts because the exemptions and deductions at the federal level are different from the additions, subtractions, and deductions at the state level. But the key terms there being taxable income and AGI.
Do they roughly turn out to be roughly the same number for people, or it's all over the map?
It's all over the map. I can look into getting some broad strokes for relationship. I didn't happen to look at that particular one. So that's, again, just context for getting into some of the nuts and bolts of the tax credit. So I have another example here. The CDC is the Child Independent Care credit, and the WFC is the Working Family Child Care Credit. I guess I lost a C there. So an example, family of three with $250 in child care per month. So that's $3,000 per year. So if they had income...
Do you mean they pay $3,000 for child care?
Per year. They're paying...
Very low. Okay.
Madam Chair, yes. One of the examples can be very helpful. They can also be tricky to put together.
Okay.
In terms... Because people will interpret them different ways as, well, this example must be normal or what it is for everybody.
Mm-hmm.
And I was trying to get to a couple things here about the child and the CDC and the WFC and the refundability piece of it, but yes. And I do, yeah. So from that $20,000 for Oregon, we take away the standard deduction, roughly $3,400, and their taxable income is $16,595. And we apply our rates, which are 5, 7, and 9, to that taxable income, and the gross tax is $1,032. The personal exemption credits, this is the Oregon version of the federal personal exemption. This is our credit. There's a credit for each person. It's in the neighborhood. It's just shy. It's about $190 a person. So from that gross tax of $1,032, the personal exemption credits reduce that by $573. So we can get to this concept. Now, this part isn't a line on the tax return. This is part of that simplification or attempted simplification. The tax credit before any of the child care tax credits come into play is $459. The CDC is a $900 credit, and this one is non-refundable. So they have $459 of tax that can be offset. That $900 wipes that tax out, so the tax after the CDC is zero. It just eliminates their tax liability. But in this example, they're also eligible for the Working Family Child Care Tax Credit. And in this example, that credit is $1,200. So they file their tax return on April 15th, and the state will send them a check for $1,200. And that's the refundability nature of it. So even though their liability was zero, they will get that check for $1,200 on April 15th, speaking somewhat metaphorically.
Do you have any other examples that you've prepared?
I just did the one.
So the one thing that I would point out, though, is that if someone's making $20,000, that's roughly minimum wage, 40 hours a week, it's unlikely they would find child care for $250 a month. If they're working full-time, then they would need full-time child care unless they had a parent at home who could take care.
Right. And this is the annual income. Yeah, I could put together a lot more examples. They all started to feel the same.
Yeah.
But yeah, the Working Family Child Care Credit, if the child care were $9,000 instead of $3,000, then the Working Family Child Care Credit would be $3,600. And they'd get a larger check.
Mm-hmm. Yes, please ask questions.
thank you, Madam Chair. So, but to clarify on that, if their expenses were $9,000 for child care, the Work and Family Child Care Tax Credit would increase, but it would not actually change their zero liability by the CDC, the tax, or right? Because that would zero out either way. So out of the two tax credits, one it would still benefit them. They would get more back if the expenses were higher. The other would still zero out, so that's the only one that would be affected.
Chair Kennegeier, Vice Chair Stark, that's correct. The child and dependent care credit would also go up. It would go up from $900 to $1,800 or something. But their tax before, if I didn't change any of the other parameters, the $459 would still be here. This could be $1,800. It's still going to get to zero.
Right.
And so the only way, and this highlights the value of the refundable nature of the tax credit of the working family.
Representative Hayden.
Thank you, Chair Kennegeier. On this example, could you tell us what their tax burden may have been for somebody making $20,000 a year, AGI, what their tax, how much taxes, if any, was actually taken out of their check monthly? for the state.
Chair Kenny Geyer, Representative Hayden, I don't have an average off the top of my head. They could set up their W-4 to have that be fairly small. I would need the withholding tables to get at kind of the average.
Well, you got three kids, and let's say this is a single mom.
I'm afraid I don't have the withholding tables at the top of my head. But I shouldn't conjecture as to what it might be. I can get that answer for you.
Go ahead. Philip, I'd be interested to see that because I think I've expressed interest before. If somebody qualifies for that $900 child care tax credit in a second year, I would be interested in making that accessible to them on a monthly basis for the 12 months going forward after they've already qualified, or whatever they qualify for that year. And this family qualified for $900, not necessarily talking about the refundable working families ones, but so they could in effect get $80 less off of their tax burden per month. And so my interest is, do they actually pay $80 in taxes to state taxes every month? And I'd rather have them get that money up front, meaning the state doesn't take it from, so they actually have it then to pay for that child care, rather than wait till April 15th and get the $1,200 or the $900 12 months later, because by then child care is important. But so it's just kind to help the cash flow.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. It sounds like you're trying to get a cash flow issue.
Yes.
And I can look into the withholding tables a little more detail about getting what those averages would be, because presumably these folks haven't hired a CPA to figure out their W-4 to get it down to zero. They can, but
I know you're,
I wouldn't guess that would be the starting point.
I'm guessing that a good group to bring in when we open it back up to public hearing would be Cash Oregon, that advises a lot of these groups. Mm-hmm. There may be others as well, but it does make sense for them to withhold as much as they can, so that's a way of making sure that they're not paying out as much.
But I think
if they increase the number of dependents so that they're not having as much withheld every month.
I think part of what happens is they're told, well, just claim more dependents even though you don't necessarily have that many kids, right? Well, why should they have to do that? Why should they have to claim something that isn't true? I'd like them to be able to have an avenue to utilize it without making a false statement on how many deductions they're claiming.
Thank you, Chair Kinninger. I wanted to also point out, make sure all of us are catching this difference. When it zeroes out there, the tax after the CDC, there's $551 that you may be viewing as lost because it zeroes out, but there is a five-year carryover. And so that can accumulate year after year. So if next year's expenses for this person was $9,000 in child care instead of the $3,000, they still have that money. It's basically like they've set that money into a pool or savings for their child care next year. And a question on that is there a limit to what that carryover can accumulate up to?
Chair Gennigai or Vice Chair Stork, there's not a limit on it, but there is that five-year. They will expire. Presumably somebody who's in the middle of carry forwards, it gets to be an accounting thing where if you have a couple, if you carry forward, so this person carries forward $441, if my math was correct. And in the next year, they might carry forward some more. But presumably that $441, there'll be an order in which they want to use the credits. They want to use the oldest credits first so that they can eventually carry forward as many as possible. So, but there isn't a cap that you can only carry forward $1,000 or something. There's not a dollar cap on that. No.
On the carry forward, for the federal, I'm sorry, I can run upstairs real fast, but, when your child hits 17, you can't take the federal child tax credit. If suddenly I've got a 17-year-old kid and I'm carrying forward credit, I mean, at some point, they kind of don't need the daycare anymore. So are they still carrying forward the credit, that they accumulated when the kid's 12 and now they're way past kind of a child care age that just kind of goes in perpetuity till it's gone? Or is it actually need-based based on I'm still accumulating child care costs?
if I understand the question, there's a five-year limit to the carry forward. So if you have a child who you incur child care costs when the child is 10, then those credits can't be used by the time they're 17 because that's 7 years later. But they can be used up until the time they're 15 because it's not really tied to the age of the dependent at that point. I mean, they were 10 when the child costs were incurred, so they were legitimate costs then, and you earn the credit when the child was 10, and any unused amounts can be carried forward for 5 years.
Although it's only until age 13, I think, in this case.
Right? Okay, I might have misspoken on the age of the child.
But the follow-up is there is whether I accumulate any new daycare cost or not. That is a carry forward that I can continue to use.
Carry forward the expenses when the kid was 10, or do you have to incur new expenses when the kid is 13?
Keep the credit alive.
I will double check, but I don't think you need to incur new expenses to keep the carry forward alive.
Gotcha.
But I will double check.
Thank you, Chair Kinnegar. Do you have any data showing how many people are actually utilizing the carry forward option? Doesn't seem. Do you track such things like that?
To some extent.
Yeah.
It does come down to a very technical aspect of what gets filled out on the tax return. And to the extent that DOR can separate those pieces on the tax returns, we can get to that information. Nobody has asked, but all of the data in the tax credit report begins in 2005, or a lot of it. And the reason for that is the tax forms changed in 2005. Mm. Prior to 2005, we had about six tax credits that were line items on the return and then other. And everything got put into that. With 2005, DOR changed the forms where people filled in a code. And so since 2005, we can actually go in and figure out which code gets aligned to which credit. So the carry forward, I'm kind of going off memory here. I think there's a separate line for the child and dependent care credit. But I'll have to follow up on that as well. Mm-hmm. It comes down to that issue, whether it gets tracked separately. Mm-hmm. And I know the Department of Revenue is actively always looking at that issue in terms of tracking these credits. Mm-hmm. And it's also something they're looking at with their, if anybody's familiar with their core systems replacement, in terms of improving their ability to do that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm. Any other questions on this slide so far? Okay,
the next few slides are just some data from tax year 2012, trying to get at the question of who's claiming the tax credit. And so this is just a sampling of some of the information that we can get from the Department of Revenue. So here we have the CDC and working family claimants by AGI and the number of taxpayers. So the gray bar is the child and dependent care credit, and the orange is the working family. And you can see that the child and dependent care credit is affected more at the higher levels of income. And this gets at, even though it's phased out by federal taxable income, their AGI can be a lot higher. And so the working family credit phases out much sooner than the child and dependent care credit. And so between, for example, 15,000 and 30,000, we have 12,000 taxpayers claiming the CDC and about 12,000 claiming the working family child care credit. And then that phases out by the time we get up to $90,000, and then almost nobody's claiming the working family child care credit. I would point that out. The working family credit phases out for incomes between 200% and 250% of federal poverty level, which is tied to household size. So that's where you're going to get a family with $75,000 of income still being below the 250% of federal poverty level, is they're going to be a larger family. So that FPL increases with family size.
And what about the dependent care? What's the equivalent of poverty level?
That one is not phased out via poverty level. It's phased out by federal taxable income.
Right.
And this
equivalency, though, is there an equivalent at which it phases out? Would be equivalent to roughly 200% or?
Oh, about 80. It's going to be about $85,000, I think. On average, it'll be $85,000. Uh-huh. So about $45,000 mm-hmm. of federal taxable income is, on average, $85,000 of AGI. So the people up here that are a little bit over $90,000 of AGI, uh-huh. they had... One way to think about that is that their deductions and so forth were more than average. So that brought them down. These were taxpayers who had maybe $92,000 of AGI. Their federal taxable income was $40,000. So they still got to claim some piece of the child independent care credit.
So that might be equivalent to 300%. Do you have any rough estimate? 300%?
It depends on the family size. Right.
Okay.
And it's tough to mesh that together.
But it's higher than the
yes.
working family.
Yeah.
So on the question what I would have is, in some of your like 15 to 30K folks, I mean, some of those families do qualify for the employment-related daycare, and then they can take the working families credit, and they can take the deduction, like on their copays, because some of those folks have copays. And the one is refundable on here. So is there, you know, feasibly a scenario where the state's picking up X, and then the credits and the deductions actually kind of become a net gain on the child care with the support from the state and the employment-related daycare? Does that make sense?
I think so. Chair Kennegar, Representative Parrish. I think that is potentially, and it is something I've thought about and tried to piece together. There's nothing prohibiting somebody who gets an RDC or ERDC payment from claiming the tax credits. I still have a
but
good
only
bit,
on the copay portion.
Right, on the copay portion. I still have a lot that I need to learn about the ERDC and how that works and how all of these pieces fit together.
Mm-hmm.
But between another thing that's not on this chart is the federal child independent care credit. So if the perspective is the family that is getting child care assistance, the possibilities are ERDC for the, I think it's around 9,000 people or so that get that. And I don't know how they fit in with the tax returns. Generally, I have spent some time looking at the tax return data, trying to get at this notion of how many people in the tax system are below the poverty line. And so, and I think ERDC, or the eligibility is 185% FPL. So conceivably, there are people who get ERDC and are filing a tax return. They may only be filing a tax return for a working family child care credit because they won't have any liability, but because that credit is refundable, that's a reason to file a tax return. But I'm sorry, I digress. If the perspective is the assistance received by a family with child care costs, you have ERDC, you have the federal child independent care credit, the state CDC, and then the working family child care credit. And I think that's why this is an example of the intent of leadership and taking this approach is looking at all these pieces and getting a better understanding of how they all fit together.
Just the real quick follow-up then.
Yep.
So there could be a population of people who do receive employment-related daycare. You know, we talk a lot about, you know, the copay that people are sort of having to deal with or whatever, but based on, you know, kind of where they might fall into the tax code, there could be a population of those folks then who really actually have no daycare bill at all. I mean, the state's picked up the tab, and then through the tax system, they've been able to kind of recoup the copays via tax credits and deductions that are available to them via the state and federal programs. Is that kind of how we don't know how many that number is, but,
right, we don't
theoretically
know.
There's a population of those folks out there who aren't having it really incurring any
daycare. It would be interesting to try to do some to see if that's ever the case. Because, again, the tax credits are on the copay, so do the tax credits ever equal more than?
If the one's refundable,
yes.
It probably would or
so
could.
It's refundable, but it's still only a percentage of the expenses, right? Even the working family tax credit is 40% of the copay. If you added all those things up together, does it come to 100%? If you added the federal dependent care and the state dependent care and the working family, would those ever add up to 100% of the expense being the copay?
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Conceptually, it's possible.
Is it possible? Because you have 40%. It would be interesting to see if that ever happens.
Well, it would depend if you want to include in that discussion the federal child independent care credit.
Right. No, I mean, I think it's fair to include them all.
On the table, yeah.
Representative Stark?
Well, I was going to say, I was playing with those numbers the other day, and I couldn't get it past, percentage-wise, I couldn't get it past 90% of what they paid. But that was disproportionate because there was a portion that they didn't pay because the state paid it for them. So I could get it up to, they got out of what actually left their pocket, 90% being reimbursed.
Right.
But that was actually closer to 98-99% of the total expenses because the state paid a portion through the ERDC. But I couldn't, now I'm new to this, but I couldn't get the numbers to quite hit the 100%, but it was really close.
So. This is an area where I am looking at it, and I'm trying to get more information on the ERDC. And the ability to construct an example is one thing, and then finding out how many taxpayers it actually affects. Because it's one thing to go through that conceptual exercise to see, oh, yeah, it's possible. Then the next question would be how many people actually fall into that category.
And thank you, Madam Chair. And I just want to clarify to make sure that we're all comparing apples to apples. When you refer to the federal poverty level for this discussion, that's the federal poverty level is based off of AGI, correct? Like if you say, you know, X amounts, you know, Sally, single mother of two, making $48,000 is 250% of federal poverty level. Are we talking AGI? I just want to make sure that we're not talking federal taxable income or AGI. Where does that federal poverty level fall into those, you know, the three different types of income we just looked at or ways of reading income?
I should start by saying I need to do a little more research to definitively answer that question. I think it would be closer to AGI, but I believe for federal poverty purposes, there are people who can speak more intelligently to this than I can about what goes in there. But it's kind of, I think, based on money income coming in. So if there is some other kind of cash assistance that people receive, that may not be included on a tax return. The information that's AGI comes from it's a tax return concept. So AGI only includes income that is subject to taxation by the federal government and then by us because we tie to their law. So there could be pieces of income that go into the calculation of figuring out if a family or where they rank on for the federal poverty level, but pieces of that income may not be taxable and so may not show up on the tax return. Because their public assistance, for example, mm-hmm. is not taxable. But I think that might be included in the federal poverty. And it might vary by program, too. But that's kind of on the to-do list, is piecing all of that together.
And some of the questions I have that came out of this report, should we collapse any of these tax credits, are because the dependent care covers a wider group of people, and the working family is a small subset of that, and I don't think there's anyone that falls outside of the dependent care. It's like there's a big circle, and then there's within that circle is a smaller circle of working family. Is there a way to put that into the dependent care and make sure that the state dependent care lines up with the federal dependent care, because one's based on an AGI and one's not? Mm-hmm. Because I think we could start getting at, if you combine the credit that you get for the federal dependent care and the credit that you get for the state, you start getting a sense of what percentage are you covering of the child care. So that's one direction I'm going in. The other is trying to get at the question of refundability. And fewer people claim it. Maybe you can talk to this. You had shown me another graph at one point, and I don't know if that's coming up, about the dollars spent, not just the number of claimants, but the dollars. Is that the number of dollars, right? So maybe you can explain those two and why it is that fewer people and fewer dollars are supporting families at the lower end.
So this chart is for the same two credits, the same AGI groupings, and it's the total amount of credits used. And here is where we can see, I mean, it's... The annual cost of the working family child care credit is about $22 million, and the annual cost of the CDC is about $8 or $9 million, and that's the refundability portion. So you get much more of the credit used down here, for two reasons. One, it's refundable, but it's also there's no limit on the eligible expenses that are part of that calculation. So the CDC is tied to the federal program, which has the, to calculate the credit, you take a percentage times expenses. And at the federal level, those expenses are capped at $3,000 for one child and $6,000 for two or more children. So that cap in and of itself is going to mean that the CDC is a lower tax credit. For the working family child care credit, there is no limit to the expenses for the child care. So you get 40%. If the child care costs for the year are $10,000, then the working family child care credit is 40% of that. And I think that's how it was designed, and that was sort of the policy intent when it was adopted back in 97. And then here's the average. So another way to look at it. So rather than total, and this kind of tells the same story, that at the for the CDC, the average CDC ranges between $100 and $300 per year. And the working family credit ranges, you know, it can be as high as $900. And that's part of the refundability. And this line here, declining, is going to be partially, it's average, so it shouldn't be phase out, but... So it's another way of looking at that credit. So some of the policy changes that are before the committee would be to modify this somehow. So if you wanted to take, you know, merge the credits or somehow shift the benefit, you know, from this group this way, if you wanted to focus on lower income people, the policy levers can be changed so that people in this income level that can be used to pay for other expansions.
Representative Hayden.
Chair Kanegar. So if I'm understanding this correct, from a policy perspective, if we wanted to, in theory, take the refundable part of the working family tax credit and convert that into a carry forward if they actually someday get child care needs or not, and make that convertible after their second year of needing that, what would the financial impact be of changing that refundable part to a carry forward so it actually went to child care?
I'm sorry,
so kind of complicated question there, but do we know how much is paid out of the $1,200 in a refundable portion? How many dollars we're talking about under the working family?
I can get a definitive answer off the top of my head. I believe it's about half.
Okay.
So that's off the top of my head. I can confirm that.
Okay. That's fine. And so we have in this policy a ability to suggest turning that over to a carry forward. Is that possibility?
That's a policy lever you have, yes.
And then my interest is getting that for people second year in either of these programs to be able to get that monthly off their tax liability so they actually have the money to do that.
Anyway. So I think the question, if we want to shift it so that we're helping low-income families, one of the reasons that the orange bar, the working family tax credit, is higher than the dependent care is because it is refundable. So the problem with the people at the very lower end with the dependent care tax credit is once they zero out, if they have a very low income and then a low tax liability, they zero it out pretty quickly. And so they get some benefit, but like in the example that you showed, they got about half of the benefit of the $900 that they were eligible for. So the idea between the refundable is that you're actually giving money back to people who are at the lowest end so that they can pay their child care. Yeah, I mean, it's like the ERDC. It is a subsidy.
It's a
direct subsidy.
So we take whatever portion of the refundable and put it into the ERDC.
Well, you're saying grow the ERDC as opposed to the...
As opposed to
if everyone had access to ERDC. Yeah.
Lots of topics. But as opposed to writing a check back on these, if you're really trying to get to child care, grow the ERDC,
right.
with that. But.
So one of the reasons I was asking, because I know the refundability issue is a big issue, if they're working full-time, if you have a single parent working full-time at minimum wage and they're making $20,000 or so, and they have, say, I think it's closer to at least $1,000 a month for childcare. If they're in there for full time, I don't know where you get childcare for less than that, but just say the $12,000. The personal, the dependent care, they're only getting $400 toward that $10,000 because it's not refundable. So the only way to really shift it to the people who have the lowest tax liability because they're making the lowest wages is the refundability piece of it. That's a policy question, but basically you are giving money back so that they can afford the child care. Because I think in reality, unless there's a second parent at home, in which case the parents at home, they don't have as big of a child care expense because somebody has decided to forego income and stay at home with the children. And in that case, there's not as much of a discrepancy. But if they're a single parent and they're working full time, in order to pay child care, the dependent care, which is not refundable, doesn't get them very far. It's $400 towards a $10,000 expense.
But the ERDC is a subsidy, so it's actually going to child care, right?
So I mean, for the 20% that are eligible for ERDC that get ERDC, that directly takes care of that.
So my argument is kind of help the people with the ERDC to grow your lower income rather than writing checks back on April 15th for $1,200 that probably doesn't go to, probably a lot of that doesn't go to child care.
Well, at some point they have to pay the $10,000. You know, I mean, you were talking about the car. You know, sometimes they delay getting the car fixed because they have to pay child care monthly. So the money is still going out of their pocket.
Well, on the working family, maybe I misunderstand that. On the working family tax credit, do they have to pay child care or do they automatically qualify with children under 13?
They have to pay child care. I mean, the value of the working family child care credit at the amount, the how it's determined boils down to up to the at the maximum 40% of their eligible costs of the child care costs.
So $4,000 out of that $10,000 would be what they would be eligible. So it's still on the hook for 60% of it.
And the 40% is for folks up to 200% of the federal poverty level.
Okay.
So that's,
and then it goes down.
Right.
Are there questions over here? I'm sorry, I'm looking that way.
And then just a couple of other charts. I will get random questions about who claims the credit. So just a couple of other pieces of information from the tax returns. This is the age of the primary filer. And so most of the claimants are in the 30 to 34 category. But there are some folks, you know, under 20 at either end of the age spectrum. So I don't know that there's anything surprising there. There was also a question about the number of, if I was tracking properly, the number of children receiving child care through these credits. And so at this point, the closest I could get to that right now is the number of dependents in the household, which isn't exactly the same thing. Except for one, if there's one dependent and they're getting the credit, then, you know, that's the child. But if they're, you know, four or five, I don't know we don't know from the data that we have how many of those are receiving child care. But most of the filers have one, two, or maybe three dependents. So in terms of kind of a family size metric. Oh, and this was just a wage composition for people claiming these credits and in these income categories. And the gray bar just shows that they're predominantly wage earners. The orange bar is business income. That'll be your sole proprietors, primarily your Schedule C, some pass-through entities. And then you get to some other pieces of income. And then unearned income doesn't even really kick in until you get to families with income above $90,000. So the theme here was they're primarily wage earners. So the tax credit policy options, again, just kind of feeding off, going off of stuff that I've heard discussed or testified to here. Some of the policy options before the committee would be, one, to maintain both tax credits. just in the current form that they are. You could consolidate the two tax credits. You could pull the CDC into the working family, basically eliminate the CDC and take that $8 million to enhance the working family child care credit one way or another. Or you can go the other direction. You can eliminate the working family child care credit and pull that into the CDC. And I'll talk more about that in a second here. And you could also do a split. You can keep one child care credit. You could even make it a new kind of tax credit, and then take some of that savings and increase the earned income tax credit. And where that comes into play is really at the beginning of this, I mentioned there were two themes. One was offsetting child care costs themselves, and the other was financial assistance to low-income working families. And so the earned income credit is a prominent tool that has that same policy.
A question on the shift, if we were to take some of those credits, you know, kind of looking back at your screens where you had moderate income earners, you know, in the 50 to, you know, or 60 to 75,000. I mean, when I think about a two-parent home kind of in that income range, and we don't necessarily think of them as hurting financially, and they kind of don't get lumped into those conversations, but I have to imagine if we made some shifts that there's going to be a population of people who do use those credits for daycare who suddenly are sort of priced out of daycare and have to make the decision, is it worth it for, you know, one of the parents to continue to be working given that they don't have that offset? And I, you probably maybe don't have a way to calculate where we think that kind of sort of leakage in the worker, you know, the mother who's probably who's out there working and has daycare, and particularly again two family household, moderate income, 2-3 kids. I mean, I've written some pretty hefty checks for daycare, and it's very disheartening to see that money go out the door. So I would have a concern about, you know, a family like that who is really kind of struggling to pay $12,000, $13,000. I mean, shoot, we paid $18,000 one year for daycare for 3 kids. It was very difficult, you know, but it was either that or stop working, and we had to make that decision. And so I imagine there are families that are like that, that if we made some changes, because we just kind of maybe make some assumptions that, well, they're higher income, they can absorb it, that actually moves some people out of the workplace. And would you have any kind of sense of way to calculate that based on the data that you actually have available to you, or do we just kind of guess?
In many ways, that's kind of the holy grail of the question here, because from a policy standpoint, arguably one way to view it would be to have the tax credit to be at exactly that level that where the parent or parents enter the workforce. And that's a spot on question, very difficult to answer, in part because the question is probably very personal for individual family circumstances. So to get at any aggregate data that really answers that is challenging. There's a lot of research about this concept and what it's more on all of the subsidies together that get people into the workforce in terms of subsidizing childcare, because it is such a significant cost.
And follow up is, I guess, that, you know, a large chunk of those folks in that, you know, sort of 60 to 75, 80,000, multiple kids, a mortgage and cars and, you know, daycare and two parents working. I mean, you're going to have a bunch of those folks who I think that decision-making, you know, consideration set comes with the fact that they don't qualify for an employment-related daycare. They're not somebody who is getting kind of that larger front-end subsidy, and yet that's also a population that is writing checks into, you know, into the general fund by working at that income level, that likely they have some tax liability that they are, you know, suddenly we also see a shift potentially if mom decides to be out of the work pool. And now that we change their tax structure, that they're actually also not contributing to the general fund through the income tax. And somewhere in those numbers is you'd see a loss to the general fund by not helping with the subsidy of daycare at that income level, I'm guessing.
I think those are valid points, and it's something I do spend time doing research on, trying to get at that question. But it's an excellent question. It's a very difficult one to answer.
Thanks.
Yes, Representative Buehler.
Yeah, question. Thank you, Chair. Would there be any unintended effects of eliminating the $6,000 income exemption for single parents who are going full-time to school, to college?
I'm sorry, the $6,000 exemption?
You mean the cap for two kids on the dependent care?
To be a qualified taxpayer, I think you had to have an income level of $6,000. At least that's how I read it.
I'm sorry, I'm not sure I'm following the question. Do you mean to file it, the amount of income to file a tax return?
No, to qualify for this, it's on an earned income, and you have to make at least $6,000?
Oh, I think it's indexed to inflation. I think it might be $8,000.
Is that for both of the tax credits?
The working family child care credit has a minimum, and I think it's I think it's over $8,000 now, maybe.
So does it's
written in
good
this
point.
Bill.
And it does it eliminate students then?
Well, it would eliminate a student who was not able to garner that kind of income. So could you eliminate that to qualify if you were a full-time student? Would there be any unintended effects?
The trick with unintended effects is they can be hard to predict.
Yes. That's why they're unintended, right?
That's why they're unintended.
Higher fiscal. Higher fiscal. I think we can anticipate.
But that is a policy lever. That if you wanted to change those, there's a minimum amount of earned income and a maximum amount of unearned income of interest and dividends and so forth to be eligible. I think those were the policy discussions, and so those were deliberately put into place when the policy was enacted in the late 90s. But it's certainly something you could revisit now.
Okay.
You're implying questions? Specifically for college students, though.
Yes.
And that's not in the dependent care one? Is there an earned income floor on the dependent care?
No. No.
Okay, did we slow you down? Do you have more slides?
Almost done.
Okay.
And well, I can stop whenever you want.
No.
Okay, so maintain.
Taylor.
No.
Thank you, Chair. Kenny Geyer. I just, for the folks that in the scenario you had where they made the $20,000 and then they got the $1,200 working family tax credit, do you have an end number? I mean, how many folks just end up with that being the amount they get? Is that 60% of the people who file for this? Is this 80%? I mean, what is the total number of people who end up falling? Because obviously they are not able to use the full $900. So it zeroes out, and then they get $1,200. Do you have an idea of all the people who file who just end up getting a check for $1,200?
We do have that information, and I can get it to you. I don't have it the tip of my
head. Oh, okay. I was just curious if you thought it was most of the people, or?
Well, they're going off the top of my head, there are about 26,000 people who get the Working Family Child Care Credit, and about half of them, I think, get some sort of refundable piece.
Mm-hmm.
So if, for example, and by that I mean if this example were structured so that the tax after CDC were still $500
mm-hmm.
and their working family child care credit was $1,200, their liability would be reduced to zero and then they'd get a $700 check.
Mm-hmm.
And I can get those numbers for you how that breaks down.
All right,
I have a question, Chris. Mm-hmm. Do you know, for the people that use the child and dependent care, how many of those are for children under 13 versus an elderly person or a disabled person? Do you have a breakdown of that?
I don't have a breakdown.
Okay.
I can look into it. I'm not sure if we can get that. We might be able to.
I'm wondering how much the working family tax credit and the dependent care intersect in terms of how, 80% of the families are served by the same overlap.
Well, it's, and I had the numbers in the report. There are 42,000 claiming the CDC,
right.
26,000 claiming the working family, and about 25,000 claiming both.
Oh, okay. So high percentage of both. Right.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, there.
But that also means there's a lot that are dependent care only that are not the working family.
Correct. And we see that right here. That's these folks right here. So you have in the 60 to 75,000 6,500 people are claiming the CDC, but only 1,000 claiming. And that's going to, I think, and I've spent some time thinking about it, I think that has to do with the phase out being based on federal taxable income. Mm-hmm. I think if that were switched to AGI, these would make more sense. That's one of the tricky things about this is because the definitions of income are a little bit different. And I don't have a good answer as to why taxable income was used for that phase out.
When you say that that's not consistent on kind of the definition of income, is that our definition from the Fed's definition, or we have language problems across our own statutes on these programs that aren't?
I was referring to the phase outs. Okay. The Working Family Child Care Credit is phased out on income and AGI. Uh-huh. The CDC is phased out on federal taxable income. So the difference between federal taxable income and AGI.
So page 43 gives a chart of the federal and the state tax credit for the dependent care. And you can see the top chart on page 43 is the federal, right? It's the federal tax credit for dependent care, and it's based on the AGI. But the state one is based on the federal tax income.
So I guess the follow-up question is there any benefit as we have this conversation of making those things kind of an apples-to-apple? So we're using one set of criteria? I mean, it doesn't make sense to, even from, it's a complicated conversation for those of us sitting up here, and, you know, some of us understand tax law. But, you know, I can't imagine being the person at home trying to figure out, well, if I do I qualify for this piece and which number do I use, streamlining that maybe something we can get accomplished. And if we do that, what's kind of the benefit of going one way or the other in turn, you know, both either as a savings to the state or as a some as dollars we can pass back to you know, the person who's using daycare? And is there a sort of a sense of making one change would have an increased cost or, you know, some kind of savings?
I think there are a lot of arguments for making that change. Tax simplification, I mean, the tax code is complicated enough. We don't have to try extra hard to add complication. And within that, just changing the definition, there may or may not be a revenue impact piece to that. It depends on how that's done. For example, the child and dependent care credit, by the time you get to $45,000 of federal taxable income, you don't get it anymore. Okay. If you wanted to go with a revenue neutral policy and just convert that phase out schedule to AGI, that $45,000 would be $85,000 of AGI. And then you're on average getting the same people. You're definitely, well, you're most likely to get winners or losers because everybody's tax situation is a little bit different. But on average, when we talk about $45,000 of federal taxable income, I could just as easily refer to $85,000 of AGI. And that's why that's where these people right here, once your tax federal taxable income gets above $45,000, you're not allowed to claim the credit. But here we have people whose AGI is between $75,000 and $90,000 claiming the credit. That's because their deductions and so forth bring that $85,000 of AGI down to below $45,000 of federal taxable income. So,
and on top of that, they do get the federal because there's no limit. They don't phase out totally. On the federal AGI, anyone at $43,000 or above gets a 20%, so they get $600 off of, for one dependent, and $1,200. So they're already getting that on the federal. So
I think the bottom line, this piece and this discussion right here serves as an example. It's a distraction from the core policy issue of child care. There's discussion about, okay, well, what do all these tax terms mean? And they're not really, and they're arguably not really relevant to the child care tax credit policy that is before you. I mean, we're in that situation right now, but that can be changed.
Mm-hmm. Any other questions?
Okay, under maintaining, just a couple more slides here. Again, I can stop whenever you want. to maintain both tax credits, you can scale them down to fit the tax credit budget. in just a proportional reduction. You can maintain the current structure, or you could even go the other direction and increase one or both of the tax credits. You have a lot of policy levers before you. You can adjust the income levels to either expand or contract, and you can adjust the share of eligible expenses used to determine the tax credit, as well as those percentages. So an example of eliminating the CDC and using that savings to enhance the working family credit. So by eliminating the CDC, that's about $7.8 million that could go to enhancing or increasing the working family child care credit. You could increase the percentage. You could change the phase out for the federal poverty level. Right now it phases out between 200 and 250 FPL. You could change that to between 250 and 300. And you can expand that, and I would work at that to figure out what that expansion would be, given the policy levers that you want to pursue, how to spend, if you will, that $7.8 million and how that could be changed. Now, each of these, there are different advantages and disadvantages to the working family and the CDC. And my next slide is the reverse, where you pull the working family child care credit into the CDC. So some of the advantages, and again, these are all perspective-driven. But an advantage of the working family is that it's refundable and that there's no limit on eligible expenses. And disadvantages to the WFC, there are higher administrative costs and it's not tied to federal law. Those are kind of one and the same. I was talking with the Department of Revenue, and the last estimate, and I think they were still refining numbers, but it costs them about $500,000 a biennium to administer the Working Family Child Care Credit. It's an Oregon-specific law, whereas the CDC, a lot of the definitions are in federal law, so the cost to administer it is a lot less because we just point to the Internal Revenue Code.
And I think I also heard that part of the higher cost for the working family one is because the IRS is not monitoring it, to the extent that you need to do audits, it's all under the state, whereas the other one, you can rely on the IRS to do the audits.
That's correct, because the working family is in Oregon only, so I think there are a couple of positions at DOR that focus on this credit in part, whereas in the federal one, the CDC, there's an information exchange between the State Department of Revenue and the Internal Revenue Service. Mm-hmm. So the state gets to leverage some of the compliance work done by the IRS. And then going the other direction, eliminating the working family and pulling it into the CDC. So by eliminating the working family, you've freed up, so to speak, about $22 million. And a couple of possibilities there. You could double the percentage used to determine the credit amount for the CDC. Right now it's up to 30%. That could go up to 60%. And if you just double that cost, that would cost about $16 million. You can increase the cap on eligible expenses. You can still tie to part of the federal program, a lot of the definitions, the caps of $3,000 and $6,000 in federal law. For Oregon purposes, you can go with a different function of that. It doesn't have to be that same cap. You can go with double it or one and a half times that, or just have some other cap imposed, but still leveraging the federal law.
Representative Parrish?
Thanks. If you, went this path and then you had it refundable for, maybe certain income levels, is there any kind of sort of constitutional question about equity if you say, well, for this group, this group could get a refundable, and this one maybe based on higher income could still take the deduction, but it wouldn't be refundable? I mean, there is some question in other areas of tax code where we've set things based on income that, would otherwise be sort of universally applied that, people kind of raise red flags on.
If I'm following the, are you talking about making the credit refundable for some people and not for others?
Yeah, because if you went this route and said, well, we'll do this and still have some of those higher income earners and or what would be perceived as higher income earners, and then made it refundable, I think that there would be pushback, certainly from maybe some of the advocates for doing that. But could you theoretically make refundable based on one level of income and, just as a credit for a different level of income and not run into an equity issue?
I'd have to check with Ledge Council, but I can do that.
Okay. So if we did this proposal, what I'm hearing, I just want to reconfirm this, what I'm hearing, this is more efficient because it kind of follows a federal process, and so you don't have to have as much oversight or FTE employees watching this. You would be able to increase the percentage of, you know, 60% or something. This is significant. It's actually making it the CDC significantly larger, right?
That's correct.
But you're still 87, I think you said 87% of your families did both. Is that right? So it's still serving the same population generally. Is that correct?
Correct. There's a lot of overlap between the two.
There's a lot of overlap between that. At what point do we sit down and kind of hash this out? Yeah. I mean, how does that work?
So my thinking on this, not having been in this position before, is that we would raise these kind of issues. We're not going to move them right now. I have a vice chair meeting tomorrow, so I wanted to go over with my vice chairs how they think we should handle it. We can have, we're having, the only time we can have a big open group with more than a quorum is in this kind of setting. Otherwise, we can meet in smaller groups for people that are really interested. As long as we don't have a quorum, you can have a small work group. So each of the vice chairs could get some information. I'm happy to continue working on this. I think it's really, really important. It's a huge piece of supporting families, and I think we're trying to wrap our hands around this. So I would welcome anyone who wants to sit down. And I think if you're interested in doing that, the Democrats let Vice Chair Peluso know, and Republicans let Vice Chair Stark know if you're really interested. And then tomorrow we'll try to figure out how to go forward. I think that getting some more input from Cash Oregon and others, but I think trying to streamline, I think, makes a lot of sense, but making sure that we have to all stay, my personal goal would be to help the people that are really struggling at the bottom, and how can we do that? So I think the refundability is a big question to grapple with. Saving administrative costs, I think, makes a lot of sense. Making sure that we can compare apples to apples, so having it more in alignment with the AGI makes sense, so we know how we're really supporting people. How does ERDC, do we say at the bottom end we're going to try to cover roughly with all of the things together, leave it just the tax credits together, we'd love to cover 90% or something like that, so people are only spending 10% on childcare. What does that mean to ERDC? Because their copay, what they're spending on childcare, is presumably less than what other people are paying. 90% of that is, on the same income level, is less than 90% of people that don't have ERDC. So how does that weigh into it in terms of fairness? I think those are some of the questions. And for me also, can you do this instead of just picking numbers to match what we have on the federal, and I don't know if those are indexed, can we attach that somehow to the poverty level? Because the poverty level does rise when you have more children. So as you were saying, if you have three, I think at least four of us here have at least three kids and have been in that situation. So, can we attach ours to, can we index ours to the poverty level would be another question I would ask. Yep, Representative Buehler.
Chair Kinney-Geyer, how did we get to this point where we have two programs that are so closely aligned but not really aligned? Did one predate the other? What was the intention of running two systems simultaneously?
Well, I think that Chuck Sheketoff addressed that a little, but you might be able to. The dependent care came first.
Okay.
It was a federal program that we adopted, I think, preceding the working family. I'm guessing that John Mullen and the audience may also have.
So why didn't they choose this option from the very beginning, I guess, is what I'm trying to get at.
For me to answer that question, I would have to do more legislative research. I
would like to invite. So would you like to hear from somebody who was involved early on with this? We can. Do I have to close? I can invite someone. John, would you like to come up and clarify for us the origins of the working family tax credit, which I understand came later than, I think, in 97, Chuck Sheketoff was saying?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, John Mullen with the Oregon Law Center. I can't speak specifically to it. I wish I had that information at my fingertips. But I think, to Representative Buehler's larger point, this is something that happens often with tax expenditures. There are things that happen at different times and different places. And I think that the effort that now the legislature is engaged in really gives us the opportunity to look at things more holistically going forward, not only addressing the policy issues, but how things work together. So I think certainly the Oregon Center for Public Policy, if Chuck was here, he could jump up and just explain the whole history. But I wasn't down here as a full-time advocate during that period of time.
Not a question necessarily for John, but maybe for Chris. You know, you brought up the notion of, well, there is a lot of history with these programs, and certainly totally different schools of thought, I think, put them forward from years ago, listening to similar conversations in this committee. The question I have is maybe a process question around, you know, this is not uncomplicated material, and I think that there is a willingness from people in this group on both sides to solve it. And so the question I have is, are you able to produce enough data for us to get to the right decision in this session? Because we're going to have to get bills out of our committee or bounce something down to rules, and that's always a difficult conversation when, you know, we're not finished with something, it goes off to rules, and people haven't heard anything about what the heck we're doing. And sometimes, even with the best intentions, we don't always get the best policy that comes back out of that. Do you have the ability to get us enough of this, the data that you're hearing us ask questions for, so we can get to a good decision? Or is this something that, you know, we end up spending some interim time on so that we can truly get it right? I mean, I think the intent is, you know, for those of us who care about these issues, is how do we come up with a really solid work product, you know, that doesn't leave somebody out, doesn't inadvertently, you know, pull someone out of the workforce because suddenly we've, you know, kind of iced them out of an income level, et cetera. And I want to be really kind of deliberative about coming up with, you know, a final solution that we don't have to come back and make a whole lot of technical fixes, or, you know, start hearing from screaming constituents that we didn't, you know, we caused them heartburn in the tax code.
I think it depends on the nature of the questions. I mean, we do have access to a good bit of information, but not everything. Some of the questions you asked earlier about if it were changed by some marginal amount, does that mean for some family that they're now in the decision, well, since I don't get the credit anymore, do I have to leave the workforce? Those are tough questions. I don't know if the data for that kind of thing is available. But for a lot of the questions, or for other questions, we should be able to get at a good bit of information, again, from the tax return. It really comes down to the nature of the questions.
So we don't know if Sally, who is making that decision about leaving the workforce, could leave, but theoretically, based on just, you know, mom with two kids who is, you know, families at this income level and leaves, you could probably pull together some information maybe about how that would make an impact into the general fund. And I'm, you know, this, I keep coming back to this in terms of the income tax that family would have otherwise maybe been paying. And I come back to it because I, you know, I used to run a school lunch program. I had 50 some women, maybe like one or two guys, who served school lunch. Several of those women, a lot of those women, worked very professional careers. I had nurses and people who literally opted out of the workplace and went to, you know, basically a $12 or $13 an hour job so that they could, you know, be tracking with their kids, still have some level of a health care benefit, but were now absolutely out of their chosen field and not in the workplace that way, because to have children and need after school care and before care and the juggling, frankly, they weren't practicing nurses, and they weren't practicing, you know, people who had accounting backgrounds and things, and they were just serving school lunch, and that's a needed job too. But we were now displacing people out of the workplace in that kind of mid-tier income. And so, you know, I've witnessed it for several years and watched those folks make that choice, and that comes with a repercussion that could maybe be quantified, I think, in this process. Even if we don't know how many of those folks, at least we could get a sense of, you know, if you're, you know, in this kind of scenario or a couple different kinds of scenarios, and one of those income earners leaves, that there's actually a hit to the general fund when they leave.
Well, I don't want to overpromise what we can deliver in a session, but I also don't want to say that we can't get that certain information.
Okay. Go ahead, Representative Buehler.
Thank you, Chair Kindergar. I think two questions would help me sort through this complex topic a little bit. One is I'd like to know the objectives of the original legislation that created the WFC. I think that would be important. And two, I think it'd be helpful also if the work group or the committee clearly outlined what problems we're trying to solve in this. Because there's a lot of moving pieces here, and I think we need to simplify it down to a few key objectives that we're trying to accomplish or problems to solve. And that, I think that'd help us kind of focus a little bit.
Part of so the first one of those, what I did in putting together the report, I went back to at least the documentation that I could find. And so that's, I tried to summarize that in the document here. That's not the same as somebody who actually lived it and was in working in the building. And there are still some people around who can say, well, they were there and they were part of these discussions. So that can be augmented.
It's in this document?
I'm not sure. It's in the larger report. It's on page...
Page 42.
Yeah.
Right. Page what?
So the policy purpose, page 45 for the working family child care. It talks about three different policy purposes. Representative Gallegos. And John, are you okay sitting there, or would you like to be excused?
I do have something I could add to the discussion very quickly.
Yeah.
A question that arose about the poverty level.
Yep.
The poverty level is based on gross income. And so there was a question about...
Gross income, not AGI.
That's right.
Yeah, I just want to... Thank you for the presentation. You know, I think this is much more into the weeds than we usually get in terms of policy presentations. And just I just wanted to thank you for your Appendix D, because that does help me, I think, distinguish between what we're trying to get at in terms of policy versus what the Ways and Means Committee is going to deal with in terms of, you know, what gets funded and what doesn't. And remembering that we're not so much interested in that as we are in trying to determine the policy implications. So thank you for that.
You're welcome.
And Madam Chair, if I could say one other quick thing, because I think this is just really terrific discussion that's gone on in this committee, and this is what advocates have wanted all along, is by sunsetting tax credits to have these kinds of discussions, because these things grow up at different times for different reasons, and sometimes it's really obscure. Chris has been doing his detective work. So in some instances, when the policy may not be clear, it will be part of your opportunity to say, here's what we really want to accomplish with this, and here's how we want to modify it, and send that kind of information down to the Joint Tax Credit Committee.
Right. I mean, I will say for my goals for this is that we support low-income families that are struggling with the very high cost of child care so that we can keep people in the workforce, as you say. And I think the working family from the graphs there has been more able to do that at the lower ends because it's refundable and because it's more generous. And the other one is has been more helpful because they have a higher tax liability to which they can offset, is better at the higher ends. I would probably advocate shifting that somewhat, but not to the point. Like, I want to know that level too. And I think one of the reasons that ERDC is going from 100, the proposal is to go from 185% to 250% is for exactly that reason. It's the cliff, and it's the point at which if we're not giving enough support, it's easier for people to stay at home. And that's why in my mind I'm thinking, you know, however that 250%, if that's what has been determined is kind of the point at which you're easing the cliff, seems like we should be carrying that same thinking here. And so what is roughly, it's frustrating that that is based on gross and not AGI. So I keep wanting to do apples to apples. But that would be the policy goals I think that we should be doing is it's an employment and a support and help lift families out of poverty by helping, you know, helping subsidize one of the most expensive pieces. And I do think the refundable piece, if we take that out, if we close one and into the dependent care and lose the refundable, we're really losing people at the bottom because they just don't have enough of a tax liability to offset. And I think getting the money back is meant to cover not all of their child care, because it's only 40% right now. It's meant to help cover that percentage back. And whether you can do that in a monthly amount, I think is a great, you know, I think that's fabulous, because you're right. That is when they need it, if there's a way to do that. And I didn't mean to suggest they do anything illegal. I thought maybe you could claim more dependents in order to reduce your withholding. I don't know if that's, we should get Cash Oregon. Maybe you're not allowed to do that, so I don't want to advocate something that you're not legally supposed to be doing. But I think these are all really good questions, and how to try to support families and make sure that we support them while they're working and generating productivity and, you know, income tax for the state of Oregon. So that, these are great questions, and I'm sorry that we might feel like we're bashing this, but Chris did say, and Deanna, who had been here before, we're so delighted that your committee is so interested in this. I don't think anyone would be that interested. So I'm giving you a lot of work, but also thanking you for, you know, the seriousness of this. And I think on Friday when we have the elder, you know, I've been thinking if we pull the working family into the dependent care, there are other people besides children, because this dependent care is also elderly. So I've been kind of looking ahead at some of the other pieces of your report that go to the four elderly and dependent, elderly and disabled tax credits, two of which are about $9 million each, and the other two of which are almost negligible. Mm-hmm. And so I think there's some collapsing that we can do and eliminating there. But if we do make the dependent care more robust, that will make us look at those other ones in a different way. Well, maybe we're helping them out this way. Maybe we can take some of the money from that as well. So we're not going to move any of the tax credits until we have a chance to look at those. But please be looking at that. You know, who are these tax credits serving, and how can we streamline?
And I guess I would add a few bullet points on a PowerPoint are not an exhaustive list of the advantages and disadvantages of the policy options. It's really a work in progress.
Right. So, any other questions?
He's got one more slide.
One more slide.
Okay, the last slide, just to be quick. Again, coming back to the beginning, offsetting child care costs and financial assistance to low-income people. Another option is to eliminate the working family and put part of it to increasing the CDC, and another part of it to increasing the EITC. Just another flavor of the policy options you have before you, because that way you're kind of serving the dual purposes of the two. So you double the percentages for the CDC, you beef that up, and then whatever money. So a very back of the envelope estimate I made for the EIC is that if you increase that by $13.8 million across the entire program, that would increase the percentage from 8% to about 10%.
Is the EITC up to a certain age right now?
It's not a certain age.
It's not a certain age.
No. That's just
so,
that.
Right.
Yeah, it's for earned income. As income increases, it has a unique structure where as income increases, the credit becomes more valuable, and then it reaches a plateau, and that's leveled off, and then there's a phase out. And it depends on filing status and number of children.
So that's a policy discussion, because the other ones are based on expenses, like child care expenses, the dependent care and the working family. This one would benefit more people who decided, because it's not based on expenses, based on income, would benefit people who did decide to stay home. And that means they're foregoing income and they're falling into a lower income tax, and it may be for people who have two or three kids that may end up making more sense.
Yeah, you know, if you don't mind, that was kind of sitting there in the back of my head is, okay, well, what about those folks who, you know, choose to stay home, take that income hit, you know, but, you know, still need that level of support, and which, to some extent, frees up things like employment-related daycare.
Right.
And for folks who really do need to be working, particularly in a two-parent household, and yet it's still a hit to stay home with three kids. I've done it both ways. And, you know, to look at that, the other thing is, you know, with all-day kindergarten coming on board, there's a population of kids that are, you know, normally would have been a half-day kiddo whose family needs more daycare support that, frankly, those costs are going to get shifted over to the K-12 fund, and I think we probably also need to have this conversation in relation to that, and certainly in a subsequent biennium, come back one more time and take a look and see how many schools rolled out all-day kindergarten. What did that do to the kind of sort of daycare needing population when you're about to take, mm-hmm. you know, some 5 and 6 year old kiddos who are only getting 2.5 hours or whatever it is we give kids, mm-hmm. you know, kindergarten, and suddenly mom only needs support, you know, after school or before mm-hmm. school type care. I think that's going to change the daycare conversation one more time as those costs get offset into the state school fund on the K-12 side. And what does that do to free up some funds for mm-hmm. this? But obviously it's going to put some pressures on the K-12 by the budget as well.
So just so you know, I did submit an EITC tax credit, but it was way too much because we were looking at too big of a credit. But my thought had been if you cover young children, either 0 to 5 or 0 to 3 or 0 to 2, the ones where it's hard to pay for childcare because it's so expensive, and maybe you're working less and your income is really plummeting, and it's, again, a way to support families where they are. So we're playing with numbers right now to see how you can bring the cost down. So what I would, we don't need to, did you want to say anything else, John, in reaction
just
to any of this?
Also, Madam Chair, members of the committee, when you look at some of these different options, I think it would be helpful for the committee, it certainly would help me, to take a look at a number of scenarios, to take a look at what's the plus and minuses right. for individual families so that you have a real sense of right. what the policy really means for real families.
So maybe we beat this over the head enough times, but if you can please get in touch with the two vice chairs, let, you know, just give some general reaction. How engaged do you want to be on this before we hear these again? And we will be formalizing 2116 when it comes over to us, the dependent care. John, thank you so much. You may be excused if you'd like. We do have fiscal impacts for the three different bills that we're considering, if anyone would like to see
these
those.
These are revenue.
Revenue impact, I'm sorry. Revenue impact for the Office on Child Care. We've not spent a lot of attention on that one at this point. That's how they get funded. We will revisit that at some point, but the fiscal on that. The revenue impact is it would be $500,000 in 2016 and 17. Is that, am I reading that right? In the fiscal year? I don't know why it would be zero this year.
Yeah.
That's correct. All of the tax credits sunset in the middle of this biennium. So to extend them this biennium, it's half the cost of the. So it should read $500,000, then $1 million, and $1 million.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Okay. It's roughly $500,000 a year. For the Office
yes.
on Child Care.
Yes.
And roughly $21.8 million for the Working Family Tax Credit as is. And is that right?
Which bill is that?
Oh, it's 2115.
Yes, that's 21. And so that should be 21 and then 44 for each of the two biennia after that.
And it's roughly twice that in House Bill 2091, which is roughly a doubling of that. Tax credit, correct?
The thing about 2091 is that it doesn't extend the sunset date, so it has a one-year impact of
okay.
$22 million.
You have to do both in order to...
And this is a tricky thing with the legislation because all of the revenue impacts are in comparison to the current law forecast, and so we'd be watching those bills closely because right now the 2091, if that were to move forward, it only has a revenue impact of $21 million in this biennium and then zero after that. Because that bill doesn't change the sunset date, whereas, and then if you had the other bill that changes the sunset date, that bill doesn't contain the policy of doubling the credit. So there's a, without getting too much, there's a chance to miss a revenue impact there.
Okay.
Can I ask one more question?
Yep.
And it's not even a fully formulated question, Steph, but forgive me. You know, we're looking at like direct tax credits and things to the employee, but what are maybe some possibilities through the employer? And specifically, you know, I mean, you have sort of the flex spending type accounts that exist where I can put money in pre-tax for my daycare co-pays and things, and we haven't really talked about, you know, who's using those, in our state, and our, you know, what income level families are able to tap those. But then also, you know, what would it look like to have, you know, more robust opportunities at the employer level, and what would we have to do at the state to maybe offset that, so that the, you know, to Cedric's point about, you know, getting the money to the people directly, that the money's not necessarily going through the state to Sally, but that the money's going through the business to her. And, you know, I mean, I think we should maybe add that into our consideration set, that there might be yet one more way to think about this, and that would be robust employer programs that somehow we are, you know, offsetting at the employer level and using that to get, you know, Sally money directly, and certainly, you know, help folks leverage flex spending accounts that let them take the daycare pre-tax at the federal level.
The flex spending accounts, that's, we're tied to that through federal. That's in federal law, so mm-hmm. we're tied to that. And none of that will show up on a tax return. So the information to get at that, I'd have to see if there's a different way to get at that information.
Isn't it a code, though? Like on your tax, you know, it's like one of the LUT numbers in the far
it
deep south part of your W-2 that says there's some code that says that, you know, you contributed money to an HSA or an FSA.
Actually, yes, there might be something on the W-4.
And I'm curious how many people are, if we have data on that, I'm curious how many people are using that, because that actually might be another tool that I think needs to maybe be in this conversation, is, you know, helping folks do those, or incentivizing employers to offer those, or, you know, actually encouraging employers, not necessarily through a mandate, but incentive of, you know, a more robust, and then creating the tax offset to make that happen, so that an employer can do that and the money gets routed to Sally, you know, via the employer.
We do, there is the one tax credit, and I think that's in 2116, that's in the employer provided assistance, the Medicare assistance. And that's in the, or is about to be in the
business and labor.
Business.
That's
and labor.
The one we just referred that's to business and labor.
And that's the only one. And that's largely for referral services. The state used to have one for facilities, so on-site facilities. But that was allowed to sunset. I don't, and I'd have to dig into why it was allowed to sunset. But I don't know that it was. It was a 10-year credit. It might have been the structure of the credit. But the intent there was. I believe along the lines of having daycare facilities at the employer location, and that's probably only going to work for large employers. Otherwise, you have an economies of scale that isn't going to make a lot of sense.
But they have an opportunity to look at that and broaden it to small employers. Any other questions?
Just real quickly, again, I appreciate the thought process. You know, as we were talking about the refunding, and I sense sort of a concern of how that, you know, if we write in a check and that might be spent. I mean, relationships with financial institutions that could help with savings accounts and those sorts of plans to help people manage their money on a very simplistic level. I think that's part of our goal here in these kinds of conversations, is to think a little differently or outside the box to see how we could, you know, give people opportunities to invest and to learn all those sorts of things, I think would be helpful. And I don't believe that's your responsibility. I think that's where you partner with the nonprofits and those folks that can assist that way.
Interesting. Ironically enough, there are other tax credits in the report that do that. They're related to individual development accounts. Mm-hmm. They have very specific goals related to them, but part of the theme there is a financial education.
Right. And are those in our committee, do you know?
I
do you remember. I don't
think, so. Think they're in your committee.
we're gonna ask for a re-referral. Okay. All right. Any other comments? Then I will close the work session on House Bill 2091, 2113, and 2115. At our next meeting, we will hear House Bill 2031, 2824, and we will have a work session on 2610. Any questions? All right. With that, I adjourn.
Committee.
All right. Adjourn.
Committee.
All right. With that, I adjourn.